From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. As the effort to paint Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump as the political heir of Adolf Hitler has accompanied his rise over the past year, and more recently, as his demonization as a Kremlin puppet was launched in the run-up to the Democratic National Convention last month, a number of prominent leftist commentators have joined the chorus. The most recent addition to what Black Agenda Report's Glenn Ford called the big nasty tent surrounding the Clinton campaign is Professor Adolf Reed Jr., professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, who specializes in race and American politics. Professor Reed has a long resume of progressive activism, which includes his being a founding member of the U.S. Labor Party. He's a regular contributor to The Nation and The Progressive. This past week, Professor Reed penned a piece that was published at the website commondreams.org entitled "Vote for the Lying Neoliberal Warmonger, It's Important," which advocates voting for Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton. We discussed that piece with our regular contributing political analyst, Professor Anthony Montero, via Skype from Philadelphia, Monday. Professor Montero, it's a pleasure to have you back.
I'm glad to be here, Don.
Well, a whole lot of stuff going on out there in the swirl around this campaign. One of the most remarkable pieces, though, was something that you forwarded to me yesterday, which is Sunday, in Common Dreams by Adolf Reed. It makes the argument, vote for the lying neoliberal warmonger, it's important. And that invokes a campaign against David Duke in Louisiana in favor of a guy who everybody knew was a crook and who ended up in prison shortly after the election. They were saying then, vote for the crook, it's important.
Yeah. Oh, it's a quite interesting thing, because he ends up saying vote for Hillary, who he acknowledges is a crook, is a warmonger, and is a liar. And he never tells us why we should vote against Trump or why we should not vote for Stein or Johnson or not vote for the top of the ticket. He only says that things could be a nightmare under Trump. But he says that the one we should vote for is a nightmare, a known nightmare. So it's a very strange argument, and not becoming a tenured professor at an Ivy League university with a certain public intellectual presence and a kind of a bona fides as a left-wing thinker. So it seems that Adolf Reed, and I would assume many others, are in a kind of a quandary. Where are they to go in the name, in the case of Reed, in the name of the working class? So that's kind of where we are right now.
He did something that has been going on now for a good long while, and that was to invoke 1932. He talks about Thalmann, who was the chair of the KPD, the German Communist Party, at the time, and makes an analogy, which he calls an allegory. You pointed that out, but I noticed that too, with the election that revolved around. It was Paul von Hindenburg, who was, I think, 84 years old and senile at that point, running for re-election of the Weimar Republic against Adolf Hitler. And the Social Democratic Party, or the SPD, which is, I guess, the analog to the Democratic Party here, or the analog to progressives here, it's difficult to parse what they intend, was saying that everyone has to get behind von Hindenburg in order to prevent Hitler from coming to power, and that consequently, and that Thalmann had said that the Social Democrats were a greater threat to the working class than the Nazis, and then points to Hitler's rise as evidence of the fallacy of Thalmann's thinking on the one hand, and also that Thalmann had something to do with it. But he leaves out the history, which is that von Hindenburg won the election, appointed Hitler chancellor almost immediately, and then in a matter of months handed over the state to Hitler as chancellor with unlimited powers. And then Hitler, in turn, went after the left-wing part of his own base, the so-called brown shirts, murdering them and others that were perceived by him as a threat. In other words, what would happen here would be Clinton gets elected, hands the state over to David Duke, who he holds out as the big threat here, or to Trump. And then they, in turn, assume, or actually they're handed, the dictatorial powers, and they use those to kill, essentially, Democrats and progressives. That would be the analogy, but he doesn't take it there.
No. And you know, what you've just stated is a very complicated and, in fact, mystified part of world history. There are very, very few people who understand what precisely was going on in the left in Germany in the 1920s, leading up to the 1932 election. Right. And generally assume that it was the fault of Thalmann and the communists that a united front against what would be the Nazi party did not occur. Now, that being said, Reed is not concerned with historical accuracy then or now. His argument is not a empirically based and logically argued position. What Reed does is to throw out emotionally charged gestures, the gesture to fascism. Now, that's all over the place. Trump is the alleged fascist. Allusions to racism in the early 1990s in Louisiana. Now, after having set that up, he then proceeds, because he has the assumptions in place that the opposite of Hillary, as he says, would be, and I quote him, a nightmare. And the nightmare is extreme racism or fascism, although he says that he doesn't think Trump is as bad as Hitler, and he's too much of a narcissist to develop the type of organization that would be necessary to carry forward a Nazi or fascist takeover of the state and of the society. But you see, it is poor argumentation, faulty logic, bad assumptions that are put forward to justify what I consider to be an unjustifiable position, i.e., that Hillary is somehow, and I put quotes because Reed uses this language, the lesser of two evils. And he does not tell us at all what she has lied about, what wars she has gotten the United States in, nor the chaos that has resulted from those wars, or what wars she is planning going forward. And most people assume that the wars of the future, if Clinton becomes president, would be with Russia and or China. There are very, very few people who do not see those as two potential great wars, i.e. world wars, going forward, and that Clinton is frothing at the mouth to get into another war. She's already put forward, even during the Obama administration when she was Secretary of State, that she wanted a no-fly zone over Syria. And many people assume that she still wants a no-fly zone. And, you know, just another article in Common Dreams by Con Hallinan,
right,
which is a brilliant exposition of the dangers, the growing, day-by-day growing dangers of war with China in the South China Sea.
And the basis of that, as he points out, Hallinan points out, is the pivot to Asia, which, as we know, is actually Clinton's policy.
Yes, yes. And in a lot of ways, the regime's policy. By that I mean the American ruling class and its institutions and mechanisms that are deeper and more enduring than a presidency. So this is long-term stuff. And when you put the Trans-Pacific Partnership alongside of this military pivot to Asia, the encirclement of China, the provocation against China, the brinksmanship against China, you know, it's a dangerous situation. And then, of course, the developments in Japan, a rabid warmonger who is now the Secretary of War Defense in Japan, the rearming of Japan, the changing of the Constitution of Japan. And as bad as that is, I think the situation in Eastern Europe and along the borders with Russia are even worse. And so I don't know upon what empirical grounds Reid makes the judgment that Clinton is the lesser of two evils. If I might just add one other thing, Don.
Yeah, sure.
You know, Glenn Ford had a very important article in one of the more recent Black Agenda reports where he talks about this nasty big tent that is now the Democratic Party, with all of the neocon war makers going back to the days of the Clinton administration and really the first Bush administration and the first war with Iraq, up to the most rabid neocons of the Republican Party now crossing over to support Clinton. And Glenn Ford says this tent has become so big that the black part of it and the labor part of it are now over in the corner near the latrine. I would suggest they're probably in the clown car, not even in the tent any longer. So the Democratic Party is effectively at the level of its leadership and those that Clinton represents. The Democratic Party is the party of war, of these trade deals that take all of the jobs out of the country and lower the work, the wage standard of the global proletariat. And it is the party of domestic repression in the name of identity politics.
And of deportation and many more. You know, on the question of fascism, of course, you've been raising the question now for a long time here and elsewhere. Who's the fascist? And if you're looking at 1932 Germany, for example, as an analog, you know, you have to look at where the industrial and financial bourgeoisie lined up during that election and afterward. And they were behind Hitler at the time. In addition to that, the policy of the Nazis, their greatest enemy was not the Jews, by the way, it was the communists. And you have the Clinton campaign surrounded by Wall Street and much of what's left of the industrial bourgeoisie in the United States, and also taking this strident anti-Russian policy. Clinton's own misdeeds and those of the DNC are not theirs. They're the fault of Putin. Russia did this. And now they're calling for hacking Russia's computer network, internet.
Oh, yeah. And you know, a big thing is, I don't know if you looked at the talk shows yesterday, but Clinton people were going around to all the talk shows saying that Trump is an agent of the Kremlin and of Beijing.
Right.
Now, if this is not Cold War McCarthyite rhetoric, I don't know what is. And if the left is comfortable with that and does not see the implications of that, then it's something wrong with them. You know, one of the things about the rise of Hitler, it was a preemptive strike against the possibility of unity of the socialists, the social democrats, and the communists.
That's right.
And that being unity of the working class, to prevent that, the financial oligarchs and the industrialists and the military got behind Hitler. Because what the financial oligarchs and the military ultimately wanted was war with Russia. And Hitler promised that. Now look at this situation. What does Clinton want? And if you don't see it, you are blind or too ignorant to see. Clinton, coming out of the Obama framework, wants war with Russia, wants regime change in Russia. They are unhappy, in fact, deeply dissatisfied with Putin. And thus they want to push east. If you want an analogy, and you're right, it's not an allegory. He has that wrong. Reed has it. It's an analogy. If you want an analogy to Hitler, if that's what you want, it's in the Democratic Party. That's where it is. And I think Adolf Reed, a very good scholar, a generally honest man, and a friend, gets it completely wrong, and in so doing, disarms the left in a way even worse than the way the left was disarmed in 2008 by the likes of Bill Fletcher and Manning Marable and others on the broad left who said that Obama represented a new thrust towards democracy and peace. And he even got the Nobel Prize in his first year of presidency. So I think Reed and his followers on the left and in the progressive movement represent not a fighting left, not a left committed to resistance, not a left committed to educating the masses, but a left that has succumbed, has capitulated, and has sold out. And the sellout is so profound that it ceases to be a left and is at best a liberal tail on this donkey that is now in the camp of war, austerity, and globalization that hurts the working class.
You know, I've been watching this analogy to Hitler unfold almost simultaneously with the rise of Donald Trump in the Republican primary. And, you know, I had thought that this was something that people were coming to on their own, perhaps being fed out by, you know, the periphery of the campaign, like the foot soldiers of the Clinton campaign or also of some of the Republicans. But I'm looking at this morning at the Wikipedia piece on von Hindenburg, and there's a campaign poster there that's up on the wall of one of the buildings in Berlin that says, with him, and it has a pair of hands shaking in front of a picture of Paul von Hindenburg in his general's outfit. You know, Hillary Clinton's official campaign slogan is, I'm with her.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it seems like a deliberate invocation of von Hindenburg to me.
Yeah. It's interesting. I don't know if they went that far back in history, but, you know, Germany at that time probably represented that nation where electoral politics had become very sophisticated, and the propaganda of elections was much like PR and advertising. So you know, these slogans that obscure everything became the order of the day. And of course, Clinton and you know, branding and PR and advertising is about just that. And she wants us to believe, and her campaign wants us to believe, that in fact, being with her is supporting your best interest and the best interest of the nation and of the world. That we should overlook all that she has represented these 30 or so years of public life. Overlook all of that, including the mass incarceration of black folk. Well, her husband was president. She was only first lady. But according to them, she was a trusted and intimate advisor of the Clinton administration.
And she lobbied Congress. Lobbied Congress for all this stuff, too.
Oh, yes, of course, of course. And then unleashing of Wall Street on the people of this country, a crime that we cannot underestimate, and frankly is hard to estimate, the crisis that it led to in 2008 meant that black folk lost half of the wealth that they had accumulated after, you know, I don't know how many decades upon decades of being denied access to mortgages and the wealth that a home represents. 50% of that was lost. It hasn't been restored. The unleashing of Wall Street through the repeal of Glass-Steagall. And for those who are interested in black people and Africa, are the Haitians black? Look at the role of the Clinton Foundation in Haiti, the effort to become the main organizing capitalist, turning Haiti into a Caribbean low-wage sweatshop and opening up Haiti and its minerals to Clinton family and friends. And you know, we could go on and on, the brutal murder of Muammar Gaddafi. This is a record that cannot be overlooked, cannot be painted over with the idea of a lesser of two evils. I think Clinton, and I'll say it again, Clinton represents an existential threat to humanity at this time. I am one of those. I'm not a Bernie or Bust people. I am an anybody but Clinton person. Vote for whoever you want, and then be prepared to fight as though your life depended upon it, because it does.
Yeah, that's for sure. I think maybe we could look at finally the change that has been taking place, apparently, with the rise of Kellyanne Conway as the head of Trump's campaign. The pushing out of the guy who took Trump through the primaries, basically, and an emphasis, a reorientation, apparently, focusing on trying to draw in votes from the black and brown communities and moderating, quote unquote, what's been said before. It seems really to have moderated the coverage to a degree, although not entirely. What do you think is happening there, and what do you think are the prospects for that to have an impact on the election?
Well, I think in certain of the swing states, the handing out of an olive branch, a detente, as it were, with the black community in particular, will have some resonance. Now, Trump will never get the majority of black votes. But in states like Ohio, Michigan, parts of Pennsylvania, probably Florida, and Indiana, maybe parts of southern Illinois, that appeal will resonate. And I call it a political detente because he's doing something that no Republican has done since the 1950s, attempt to compete for black votes. And to say that black votes will matter, that if I am elected, I will do whatever I can do to relieve the suffering of black urban America, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Then you put that alongside his position on TPP and renegotiating NAFTA. You know, it's an appeal that might work. It's hard to say. Institutionally, the black community is tied to the Democratic Party. How strong those ties are yet to be seen. But I think it is a significant turn. If it does nothing else, it will raise questions that are already there, by the way, about just what the Democratic Party and what people like Clinton in particular have done against black people, to hurt black people. And, you know, Don, if we're to be honest about this, what Obama gave black people was what he called tough love, lecturing us time and time again about our failings and what we had to do. Well, to be honest about it, that was the Republican Party's approach to the black community. Non-engagement with the basic problems of black folk, but lecturing us about all of our alleged failings and what we needed to do to become good Americans in the white definition of what a good American is. So this is, at least from a rhetorical point of view, it represents something substantive and a breath of fresh air with regard to at least talking about the deep problems that confront working black America. And in so doing, he's talking about the problems that confront working class America, period. High youth unemployment, violence, drugs, despair, and what has to be done to reverse that. And what he sees is a new economic, set of new economic policies. I, as I've said before to you, he identifies problems. He does not have adequate solutions to those problems. But the fact that he does not obscure the crisis is of benefit to everyone who is fighting on the ground.
And to the discourse in general, right?
That's right.
You know, so you mentioned the outreach to the black community. He's also reaching out to the Hispanic community. And, you know, Clinton and Obama have a rather, you know, full record with respect to the question of immigration.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. What Trump rhetorically talks about, they have done in spades. They are no friend of the immigrant community or of the Latino community, period.
Policy-wise. All right, Professor Montero, thank you very much. Pleasure as always.
Thank you. Thank you, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.